Now, yesterday at the end of the hour, we were speaking about number seven, some considerations regarding evolution. We noticed small a, that it's not really science, but history. B, that there is for it no evidence of the type that history requires. We look at that a little more fully later. And C, it is actually merely a guess, and a negative guess at that. And then small d, I didn't mention at the end of the hour. I started to speak about it, but didn't state it specifically. Small d, it is generally accepted on authority. And I have that is to say, most who believe in evolution accept it on authority. Now that is unfortunate. Look, man. Oh, I see. Well, B was that there is no evidence. There is little evidence, perhaps would be better to say, though I think you could say no. There is little evidence of the type that history requires. History normally requires eyewitness testimony. You say, there are people in America today, therefore these people must have come here from somewhere. So we draw a conclusion that people came to America from other countries sometime in the past. But if you want to tell when they came, if you want to come who came, if you want to tell from what continent they came, or even if you want to be sure they came at all, that they didn't start here, you have to have either somebody who saw them or something written down by somebody who saw them that's been passed on. Eyewitness testimony is what is required for any certainty in history. Now you can have circumstantial evidence, and circumstantial evidence has certain value, but ordinarily, it's because of its connection with eyewitness history or its similarity to something proven by eyewitness evidence that circumstantial evidence is enough. That was small b. And small c, perhaps I didn't give the numbers. I remember speaking of it, though, that it is actually merely a guess, since we do not have eyewitness testimony that all things, all living things, have developed from one simple star. By change, by descent with modification, it is a guess, and it is really a negative guess, because it is a guess that God never created any type of life. And that we will say a bit more about under later head. But then small d, perhaps I should have put that as A rather than D, because it's so very important. 99% of those who accept here in evolution believe in it simply because somebody has told them so, of course. That is, the number who are capable of examining evidence on it is unfortunately very, very small. I remember about the child in school who was asked to give the proof that the world is round. Well, he said the teacher says so, father says so, and mother says so. Three evidences that the earth is round. Well, of course, if any one of them had gone around the earth, that would be a good evidence. But otherwise, in most cases, unless we've gone around the earth, most of us could not give much evidence for it. Or I've heard of people gone around, of course. It is, we take it on authority, and we take most of what we have on authority. And in connection with evolution, I have this book that I mentioned at the end of the hour from the International Series of Monographs on Pure and Applied Biology, Implications of Evolution by G.A. Kerkut, K-E-R-K-U-T. M.A., Ph.D., Department of Physiology and Biochemistry, the University of Southampton. And it is on the whole a technical work, and a work in a series of scientific treatments, such as, for instance, Volume 1 of the Biochemistry Division is the thyroid hormones, the Botany Division, Volume 1 is grasses of India, Burma, and Ceylon. See what I mean? This is a technical scientific series of books. And this one in the series by G.A. Kerkut in the Division of Zoology, Volume 4, Implications of Evolution, he begins with telling his experiences in teaching in England, in an English university. And he tells how in Cambridge University until 1927, all the students, in order to enter, had to prove they had some knowledge of Paley's evidences of Christianity. That is, he gives other evidences to show how the church held the English universities pretty much under control until comparatively recently. although in the latter years of it, it was largely anonymous. But they had to give some evidence of accepting certain theological views. And that, of course, is highly decried today, and he joins in decrying it, but he says that today you have a very similar situation, only from a different viewpoint. And he tells of his experience with tutoring students. In England, the tutorial system is quite greatly used, in which the instructor deals with very closely with a small group of individual students. Here he says, for some years, I have tutored undergraduates on various aspects of biology. It is quite common during the course of conversation to ask the student if he knows the evidence for evolution. This usually evokes a faintly superior smile at the simplicity of the question, since it is an old warhorse set in countless examinations. Well, sir, there is the evidence from paleontology, comparative anatomy, embryology, systematics, and geographical distribution. The student will say in a nursery rhyme jargon, sometimes even ticking off the words on his fingers. He would then sit and look fairly complacent and wait for a more difficult question to follow, such as the nature of the evidence for natural selection. Instead, I would continue on with evolution. Do you think that the evolutionary theory is the best explanation yet advanced to explain animal interrelationships, I would ask? Why, of course, sir, would be the reply in some amazement of my question. There's nothing else, except for the religious explanation held by some fundamentalist Christians. And I gather, sir, that these views are no longer held by the more up-to-date churchmen. So I would continue, do you believe in evolution because there's no other theory? Oh, no, sir, would be the reply. I believe it because of the evidence I just mentioned. Have you read any book on the evidence for evolution, I would ask? Yes, sir. And here you would mention the names of authors of a popular school textbook. And of course, sir, there's that book by Darwin, The Origin of Species. Have you read this book, I ask? Well, not all through, sir. About how much? The first part, sir. The first 50 pages? Yes, sir, about that much, maybe a bit less. I see, and that has given you your firm understanding of evolution? Yes, sir. Well, now, if you really understand an argument, you'll be able to indicate to me not only the points in favor of the argument, but also the most telling points against it. I suppose so, sir. Good. Please tell me, then, some of the evidence against the theory of evolution. Against what, sir? The theory of evolution. But there isn't any, sir. Here the conversation would take on a more strained atmosphere. The student would look at me as if I was playing a very unfair game. It would be clearly quite against the rules to ask for evidence against the theory when he had learned up everything in favor of the theory. He also would take it rather badly when I suggest that he's not being very scientific in his outlook. If he swallows the latest scientific dogma and when questioned just repeats parrot fashion the views of the current Archbishop of Evolution. In fact, he would be behaving like certain of those religious students he affects to despise. He would be taking on faith what he could not intellectually understand, and when questioned would appeal to authority, the authority of a good book, which in this case was The Origin of Species. I would then suggest that the student should go away and read the evidence for and against evolution presented as an essay. A week would pass and the same student would appear armed with an essay on the evidence for evolution. The essay would usually be well done, since the student might have realized that I should be tough to convince. When the essay had been read and the question concerning the evidence against evolution came up, the student would give a rather pained smile. Well, sir, I looked up various books but could not find anything in the scientific books against evolution. I did not think you would want a religious argument. No, you're quite correct. I want a scientific argument against evolution. Well, sir, there does not seem to be one. And that in itself is a piece of evidence in favor of the evolutionary theory. At this piece of logic, the student would sit back and feel that he had come out on top. After all, I had merely been questioning him whilst he had produced information. Then in his next chapter, he gives basic assumptions. And he gives seven basic assumptions, which he says are often not mentioned during discussions of evolution. Many evolutionists ignore the first six assumptions and only consider the seventh. He gives these seven assumptions, and then he devotes his book to scientific examination of the assumptions, and then his conclusion, while he gives it in detail regarding each one, amounts practically to this statement that every one of these is an assumption of which there is either no or very little evidence. It may be true, but you cannot prove it. And his conclusion at the end of the book is, there is a theory which states that many living animals can be observed over the course of time to undergo changes so that new species are formed. This can be called the special theory of evolution and can be demonstrated in certain cases by experiment. You notice he makes a division between the special theory and the general theory. Now, what he calls the special theory would be that there are a few cases in which there has been observed a new species being formed. I do not know of any case where there has been observed under purely natural conditions the formation of what scientists would agree is a new species. There are cases where under laboratory conditions, selecting certain ones for breeding and so on, there have been produced what some insist are new species, but other evolutionists would insist are simply varieties. But he says this can be called the special theory of evolution and can be demonstrated in certain cases by experiment. When you say evolution, you ordinarily mean, as most writers mean by it, that all things have developed from one simple source, all living things. He continues, he calls that the general theory. He says, on the other hand, there is the theory that all the living forms in the world have arisen from a single source, which itself came from an inorganic form. This theory can be called the general theory of evolution, and the evidence that supports it is not sufficiently strong to allow us to consider it as anything more than a working hypothesis. It is not clear whether the changes that bring about speciation are of the same nature as those that brought about the development of new phyla. The answer will be found by further experimental work and not by dogmatic assertions that the general theory of evolution must be correct because there is nothing else that will satisfactorily take its place. I thought that was very interesting from a biologist who evidently himself has no religious reason for opposing it, thinks that it may be true, but insists that it is not true, but it's merely a theory on which much more evidence is necessary before a fair decision can scientifically be made one way or the other. Then we'll go on to number eight. Number eight is a glance at the type of evidence presented for evolution. We must move rapidly here, but I do want to point out a little bit about the type of evidence, because as we mentioned, for a historical matter, what is needed is historical evidence. In other words, eyewitness evidence, which we don't have. What he said here in the beginning, well, sir, there's the evidence from paleontology, comparative anatomy, embryology, systematic, and geographical distribution. I'd like to just spend just a very few minutes looking at the nature of each of these types of evidence. The first of these, paleontology, is evidence from remains of life, of past life, buried in rocks or in other types of strata. That is paleontology, is fossils, in other words. Usually parts of the body that have been preserved. And of course, many of the parts of the body are almost never preserved for long periods after death. And also, it includes marks of footprints and such things, which are also can be clearly taken to be evidence of some sort of an animal or plant of some past time. Well, this sort of evidence comes nearer to eyewitness evidence than any other type that is advanced. Because if you found a body in a house that you were thinking of moving into, and you found a dead body there, even though nobody had seen the person enter the house, you could safely say the person had at some time entered the house. It would be circumstantial evidence, but it would be very good evidence. And, of course, it would not stand alone. You would know they had, because we have plenty of eyewitness evidence that all people have entered houses at various times, and that nobody could get into a house without entering. So we have plenty of eyewitness evidence as background, but in the immediate case, circumstantial evidence would be helpful. Now, if you were to find buried in the earth a 1,000 old automobiles, and if you were to take these automobiles and to arrange them in a certain order in which there seemed to be a certain progress from one to the other, that would not prove that one of them had developed out of the other. It would not prove that. The fact you were able to arrange them in such an order. You would have to have some evidence of the time when the cars were made. Some cars that are in use today might look very, very much more like some cars that were used 30 years ago than like some that were used 10 years ago. You would need some sort of eyewitness evidence or some definite ability to date them. And this is a big question. It's the dating of strays, of course, a very big and involved question. But you had a series of cars that went with no gap, just a little change in each, you could present a big argument for the wooden crew. But in the fossils that had been found, there are all sorts of tremendous big gaps. There's no matter one missing link. So you might say are thousands of missing links. And you find that all of the great divisions of vertebrates appear almost in the same period and rather simultaneously with no evidence to show from what previous group they would have come. And there are many different theories about it. There are all sorts of gaps in it. The evidence from paleontology, then, is the nearest to eyewitness evidence that we have. But if it was complete, it hardly would be eyewitness evidence. They could make a strong presumption, but not a proof. And it is very, very far from complete. And then evidence from comparative anatomy. And comparative anatomy, he said comparative anatomy, embryology, systematics, and geographical distribution. By systematic, he means the fact that they can be classified in an arrangement which looks like a tree, showing similarity as the group goes out. Well, most evolutionists today feel that instead of a tree, the better analogy is a shrub. That a long series like a tree cannot be demonstrated in most cases. It's more like a shrub with many that they assume come forth from a comparatively few starting point. And if you can arrange things in many different ways, that doesn't prove descent. And comparative anatomy is the same way. Similarity may be very, very interesting, but they are certainly not a proof of descent. Then he mentions embryology here. And embryology was advanced by Ernst Haeckel as one of the great proofs of evolution. And Ernst Haeckel, who we discussed yesterday in Germany, invented what he called the biogenetic law. And he expressed it in the beautiful words that ontology recapitulates phylogeny. Ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. By which he means that the development of the embryo recapitulates the development through evolution of the race. And thus you have the fish stage, and you have the reptile stage, and all these different stages through which the creatures developed. And 60 years ago, this was held to be a very, very strong argument for evolution. But most scientists have pretty well rejected this argument today. It is now an argument that is pretty well given up. Very few still hold it, because it has been shown that, in the first place, the embryo does not have similarities to the adult stages of any species. The alleged similarity is only to the embryonic stages of the different types. And after all, everyone develops from one cell into many cells, and more complex. That is a fact of the development of every type of animal, as well as of human beings. But to say that proves that evolution came the same way, that we all came from one cell into many and so on, it's not a proof at all. The specific things that might be proofs have largely been disproved. And also it is recognized that in embryonic life there are particular conditions which naturally you have changes to meet and to adapt to, which do not prove anything about evolution. So some of the leading evolutionists say that it would have been much better if this argument had never been advanced in the first place. I don't know under which of these heads, perhaps under comparative embryology, they would put what would have been one of the greatest arguments for evolution, one of the most widely used a few years ago, and that is the argument from vestiges. I picked up a book yesterday published by a leading biologist about 1905 on evolution, in which he said, man is a great museum or storehouse of vestiges. That is to say, there are all sorts of organs like the appendix and the tonsils and the muscles that move the ears and the can twist the ears. I have a friend who can do that. He says when he was a boy, his uncle who could do it simply told him to try and he did. If he ever had children, he was going to teach them when they were young to do it, because he says those muscles lose their strength when they're never used, and in most of us, we couldn't twist the ear out the way we can. But this is one of the many, many organs in the human body and in the bodies of most animals, which 60 years ago, they said were proof of evolution. And as the years have gone on, in the case of organ after organ, it has been found that it has vital significance in life, and that it is not simply a vestige at all. Until today, there are not more than two or three at most that any responsible biologist would say are vestiges, as against dozens of them, which might have been said 60 years ago. And in the case of all these others, evidence having been found of their being important, it is only reasonable to say that the reason that someone can say these are vestiges is that we simply have not yet discovered just why they are important. And so this argument from vestiges, like the argument from embryology, which used to be considered such an important argument, is pretty well evaporated today. Then the last of these he mentions is geographical distribution. And this is the point that first led Darwin to start thinking along these lines, as he said. It was when he visited the islands off the coast of South America. Too far for very much passage between them and the mainland. And he found on some of these islands types of birds very similar to those on the mainland, but a little different. And he reasoned that a few had managed to get there from the mainland, but then they'd been isolated and gradually developed in a different direction from those on the mainland. Well, about all this argument proof is that most of the life on the earth has moved from one place to another. If humanity must have started somewhere, it seems very unlikely it was on this continent. And so in the case of most types of people on this continent, they would seem to have come either from Asia or from Europe, probably first from Asia over the Bering Strait, and then later from Europe. We have spread out, and it is only natural that animals and plants spread out and move. And in the course of it, they make change. Gradually, there are all sorts of changes in life, but the fact that changes occur certainly does not prove that all things have developed by a natural process from one simple beginning. These changes are limited in extent. I was talking with a man who is a PhD in botany and taught at a university for a time and then took a position with a rose company. And he worked with them for many years, developing new types of roses. And he said he found it very easy to take a lot of roses of a certain kind and from among them to pick out the best and to arrange that these would interbreed and to select very few out of the many and then isolate these few. And by isolation, by selection, by interbreeding, he found it easy to improve any type, any group of roses that he would work on or plant. It was very easy. You could make a great improvement in a brief time. But then he said, soon you found that it was very difficult to improve much further beyond what you've done. And soon you found you reached a point beyond which it seemed impossible to make any change or advance. And he said, then if he stopped working with these and just let them go on by themselves, very soon the whole group reverted to practically the condition it had been when he first started working with them. Changes under specific situations do occur. There's no question about it. But there does seem to be a limit within them. Scripture says that God made the animals and the plants after their kinds. And how big the kinds are, we don't know. But when we take an attitude that sounds as if we don't believe there's any change or development within the kinds, we simply confuse it. Yes?
Can there be one plant across the reef to find another type of flower or
his aim was to get new types and the best possible types for this. It was a commercial company that he was working for.
Yeah.
Just the proof type. Yes, yes. That's all. He worked many years. He said that he had this experience over and over. It's very easy to improve up to a certain point. And then beyond that, he just seems to be unable to go any further. Well, the this matter then of geographical distribution certainly is no proof of that any large groups of animals or plants have developed from other major groups. Just how far it can go in the development of species, I don't know. I attended a meeting of the American Scientific Association, a Christian scientific organization, once, at which one of the members gave a talk, and he said, when I was a young man, he said, evolution was simply considered a dirty word among the people I was with, he said. We just considered it a dirty word. But he said, I got into careful study, and he said, I found that a certain island in the Pacific, he said, there was a bird at one end, a certain kind of bird, one end of the island, and he said, right next to it was another that was almost identical, and the two could interbreed. But then he said, a little beyond that was another that varied a little more, and it could interbreed with a second, and so on. You had about 10 of them. But when you got the two on the opposite ends, he said, they could not interbreed. Now he said, if there's been a great earthquake or something, and the whole middle of the island been destroyed, he said, you'd say these were two different species. Whereas now, since they can interbreed all the way across, you say they're one. And that seems to have shaken his faith in the scripture, and to have led him to feel that evolution must be true. Well, there was scripture nowhere said that Linnaeus' idea of a species is what is necessarily true. It says there are kinds, but how large the kinds are, we don't know. But from this fellow having had an oversimplified idea, he was put in a position where his whole attitude could be tremendously shaken by something that was really should not have shaken it at all. But this matter of geographic distribution, then, is an area in which you really would not find proof of evolution. You find proof that every type of life has spread and moved over parts of the world, and there are areas in which any particular type has not come. And there are certain types found in the southern part of South America and in Australia and nowhere else. And from a purely evolutionary viewpoint, it's pretty hard to see how either of them could have developed from the other. And also from the southern part of South America and Madagascar. That is to say, there it is really not an area which should give proof, but it is one which has shaken many people on this matter. Now, go on to number nine. Number nine, the question of process. Here is a little book called Evolution in the Modern Biology series by J.M. Savage of the University of Southern California. And he says in it, no serious biologist today doubts the fact of evolution. This is copyright 1963. No serious biologist today doubts the fact of evolution, the development of all living organisms from previously existing types under the control of evolutionary process. Thus, while the fact of evolution is amply clear, there are different theories regarding the significant processes that have brought about evolutionary change. He says, we do not need a listing of evidences to demonstrate the fact of evolution any more than we need to demonstrate the existence of mountain ranges. Of all the ridiculous, nonsensical statements to be made in a book by a reputable scholar, a book full of scientific evidence and information. He is getting utterly out of his field and referring to the field of history, actually, and comparing it with the existence of mountain ranges. It's fantastic. But it's interesting that further on he says, the present book is unique among discussions of evolution at the college level in its emphasis on the two crucial unsolved problems in the understanding of evolutionary processes. And the second of those is, what processes are responsible for the origin of major evolutionary changes above the species level? In other words, we do not have evidence that evolution has occurred. And he admits that we do not have any agreement as to what process may have brought about major evolutionary changes above the species level. And yet he says it's just as clear as the existence of mountain ranges. That is the type of argument from authority rather than from evidence or fact. Number 10, the extension of evolution to all fields of knowledge. When I was a student at Princeton Seminary, there were some lectures given at Princeton University by Dr. Moore, professor of physics in Ohio State University at the time. He later published these in a book under the title, The Dogma of Evolution. And Professor Moore was a physicist. And he said that certain principles discovered in physics, people had tried to carry over into biology where they did not belong. And then he said they took these from biology and they carried them over into sociology. Sociology and psychology. And he said the biologist would like to shake the sociologist off his shoulders. And the physicist would like to shake both of them off his shoulders. And Darwinian revolution was a revolution in the sense that it changed from the attitude of believing that God is active in human affairs to a purely mechanistic sort of attitude applied to all fields of life. It's interesting that this question of a process that Darwin felt at first that he had the process, and that's what made his book go. His book wasn't to prove evolution, it was to prove natural selection. Natural selection, which he later said might better have been called natural preservation, was the thing that made changes, and he assumed there are all kinds of changes, and therefore it's just a matter that if you preserve certain ones of them, then they will gradually move in that direction. But then when people asked, what makes these changes? And he himself began to wonder what made them. Then he published a book on variations in domesticated animals, about 5 or 6 years after he published The Origin of Species. And in this book, which is rarely referred to a great deal today, in this book, he discussed his theory of how these changes came about, which he called pangenesis. And he said that there are what he called gemmules, and that there are these gemmules in the reproductive organs which come from every part of the body, so that if you use your hand or your foot, or you get an injury to your eye or something, a gemmule from it goes to the reproductive organs and thus it is passed on to the next generation. And this theory of pangenesis, all the scientific books refer to it, but they usually say very little about it, because nobody, of course, believes in today. And then the next book that he wrote a few years later was The Descent of Man. And in that book, he spends a third of the book trying to prove that man has descended from animals, and the last two-thirds of it presenting what he calls sexual selection, in which he's now reached the point where he feels that natural selection does not explain everything that he thought of first. Now he says that animals that develop certain features in order to attract the other sex, and then that through this development, to attract the other sex, that this comes to be the factors that are reproduced. But as some have said, the most attractive of both sexes might be attracted to each other, but they would not necessarily be the most prolific by any means. And so his idea of sexual selection is pretty much discarded. So that's two-thirds of his book on the descent of man. But his original idea, with modifications, is now held neo-Darwinism by most biologists. But there was the professor of botany at the University of California a few years ago wrote a book in which he examined the evidences for gradual change and found that most of them were non-existent. And so he said, this idea of gradual change simply does not work. There's no evidence of it. But he said, of course we can't accept these discarded idea of special creation, so we must believe there were sudden things. And out of one kind of an animal, all of a sudden there was a saltation, as he called it, a sudden sharp break to another type. And maybe a fourth of biologists today accept his idea as to the method by which evolution came. But it's a method. Professor Goldschmidt's theory is a method which would actually be require more faith than believing that God created it. Because as he says, you wouldn't expect anybody to ever see it because it happened maybe once in a million years. But all of a sudden you get a new, entirely different type. So that it remains a matter which is without proof, and yet which affects all areas of thought today, and which has been more effective than any other single force in producing the climate, the anti-Christian climate we have now. Mr. Albright? Darwin's second book, the exact title I don't recall. It's on variation in, among domesticated animals or something like that. It's very easy to find in any account of his life because it was between it isn't his second book. He published other scientific books all through his life. But the next book after the Origin of Species. Someone over here had a question with the same one. Yes? He's either University of California or Stanford. I think it was California. He is a very highly regarded biologist, and most of the textbooks refer to this theory as a theory accepted by many, though not by the majority of biologists. No, he died just a few years ago. Yeah. Dolchin, he was a botanist primarily. Now, the basic question for the Christian is, we spoke of the question of process, and we spoke of the extension of evolution to all fields of knowledge. And then 11, the basic question for the Christian, the basic question is, does God exist at all? Does God exist at all? Because if God exists, certainly he could bring things into existence in whatever way he chose. And when we find clear proof that he did those things in certain ways, we naturally can assume it in cases where we don't have proof. But we have not found such proof. And where we have a clear scriptural statement, we can stand upon it, but we should be very careful we don't read into the scriptures what isn't there. And I think one of the most unfortunate things is reading into it the idea that the day of creation was a so-called 24-hour day, because there's no evidence in scripture for that idea, and much evidence there against it. It could be a 24-hour day, but we don't know. It could be a 6-minute day. It could be a billion years. We just don't know. God has not given the length of time. So I think we cause confusion when we read into the scripture what is not clearly taught there. And the same thing is with the idea of thinking that everything continues unchanged. There are great changes, such changes as God chooses to bring. But the idea that everything has developed from one simple source is something that is absolutely without real proof, and that sharply contradicts a number of clear scriptural teachings. Oh, yes. I think that is very foolish, the attitude which they take. That is to say, they publish, now Whitcomb has the first three chapters, in which he endeavors to prove the flood was universal, and I think he does an excellent job. Now Morris, in the latter part of the book, tries to prove that all the strata and the fossils were made by the flood. Well, there's no statement in the scripture that the flood made any strata anyway. So it's not a matter of scriptural belief whether the flood did or didn't make strata. Personally, it seems rather illogical to me to think that strata would have been made to any great extent by a flood. The scripture said it, I would accept the scripture says nothing to come. And I see no need of such a theory. Now, it could be true, but I think we simply don't know. But if I felt that it was a very important matter in relation to biblical belief, I would feel it necessary to spend 5 or 6 years studying geology in order to be able to speak. Now, Morris, I understand, is very well trained in hydraulic engineering. But I don't think that qualifies to be a great expert on geology. Yes? I don't. Is it being widely accepted? It's hard to tell. It's hard to tell. I don't know how hard it is. But since the Bible never says the flood laid straight, I don't see why we should. That's a matter of theology, not a matter of the Bible. And if a person thinks it's tremendously important, let him spend 6 years studying theology and work into it. I do believe there are some matters in theology that have not been worked out that are important. But I don't know how they would be worked out. A person would have to spend many years to do it. I don't know anybody who has. I don't think it's by one relation to the Bible. Well, now, capital G, the rise and spread of the Gross-Bellhausen theory. The rise and spread of the Gross-Bellhausen theory. The whole intellectual world has been tremendously affected by evolution. The theological world has been greatly affected by the Gross-Bellhausen theory. And the Gross-Bellhausen theory itself was greatly affected by evolution. So this is very important in understanding the background of our present situation. The rise and spread of the Gross-Bellhausen, the Gross-Bellhausen theory. Number one, the background of literary criticism. We already mentioned in speaking of the previous half century how the literary students were dividing up all ancient writings and all medieval writings and trying to show that they were derived from various sources. And this source criticism, which was so common, is today largely given up. This did not affect any great number of Christians. It affected a small number of trained people in this area, in all countries. Number two is the early Hegelian interpreters. There was a group of scholars who did some work in this literary criticism who tried to apply Hegelian principles to biblical study in showing how the ideas in the Bible might have come into existence through natural processes. They did not have much influence. They were quite distinct from the group which did most of the work in literary criticism. During the period from 1753 to 1876, there were many, many different theories of literary criticism advanced, of the division of different books of the Old Testament into alleged sources. And there was not much done on this line of these Hegelian interpretations. There were a few men about 1820 and 30 who wrote some books that had great influence later on, but not immediately. Because number three here is the union of these two. Yes? About 1872. The union of these two developments. The union of these two developments. That's what the Gross-Bellhausen theory so-called is. It is the union of the attempt to explain the development of Christianity on a basis of natural development of ideas, combined with the attempt to divide the biblical books into sources by different writers and at different times. See, these were two distinct movements. But Groff and then later Bellhausen united them into one movement which divided the Bible into different sections, putting a few verses in one, a few verses in another, a few verses in the third, and then took these sections, which they claimed were separate entities originally, and claimed that they had developed as showing a course of progress and development from very early primitive ideas to somewhat more advanced to much more advanced and so on. And thus it was the application of evolutionary ideas to biblical study. And this was known to a comparatively few scholars and had comparatively little influence in the world until about 1876. I don't have the exact date right here, but it's approximately that. Julius Bellhausen wrote in a style of German much simpler, easier to understand. He was a very brilliant man anyway. He wrote a presentation of this theory. And you notice, if it was 76 and was right near that, that would be just 17 years after Darwin's Origin of Species. And evolution had now swept the intellectual world of England and of Germany. And into that situation came this theory, which on an evolutionary basis showed how the ideas of God in the Bible and the customs and habits of the Israelites developed by a purely evolutionary development. And this is one of the big reasons for its success, is that it just fits the temper of the times established by Darwin, Huxley, and Haeckel. And so it swept like wildfire through the scholarly world in Germany, France, England, and eventually America, and made tremendous changes. And no one force has been so more influential in the theological world in destroying faith than this so-called higher criticism. The term higher criticism is not a particularly good term for it, because in the first place it's a term taken from literary study, which is now abandoned in literary study, but also because it only touches one side of the development, and actually the other and more important side, with the claim that you show thereby how from a natural process similar to the development of species, there developed the ideas of the Bible. And so this rough Wellhausen theory has been a tremendous force through this last century, nearly a century now. And during the last 20 years, there probably have been 40 books published in the English language which present it as established fact, as unquestioned fact. Books by Jews, by Christians, by Roman Catholics, books by all sorts of viewpoints presenting this theory as established fact. And so it is important for us to have in mind the tremendous influence that it has had, which is really, in a way, a part of the influence of the evolutionary theory. Its extension into this field, combined with the literary development, which was originally a different thing. And you'll find books published even within the last 10 years, we'll say, in studying the Bible, we must take the same approach we would to any other literary work. And yet this approach is not typical for literary work anymore. It is a discarded approach. I shouldn't say anymore. There are a few, very few, who take it. Yes? These were theologians, but they are, whether to call them scientists or philosophers, it depends on the individual man. Actually, if we use science in the sense of a person who studies atomic physics or something like that, they were not scientists. But if you take them as philosophers in the sense of people who theorize, they certainly were theorized. If by scientists you mean people who tried to gather facts and arrange them in a solid order, they certainly did a lot of that. Whether they arrange them in a reasonable order, they arrange them in what looked to them like a reasonable order. It's interesting that this term in English, scientist, is not used in German at all as we use it today. In German, science includes all kinds of science. It's not just what we call science in this country. It's a different, it's an English development, as far as I know. The use of science in the sense of dealing with things you can handle and touch and so on, as compared with the sort of study that deals with writing and with ideas and so on. But the union of these two developments has today had a tremendous influence in the theological world. I was at a camp some years ago, a student one summer, and I said, how many, these are all college students, how many of you have been bothered by the higher criticism? I think there were two out of maybe 150. And then I got into discussions with them, and I found that actually more than 90% of them had ideas in their minds that had been given them in classes in Bible, in and literature and philosophy, somewhere else, that were directly connected with the development of the higher system. It simply had not been called that, but it had been the theory which had a great influence in their approach to and attitude towards the Bible. We will not take much time on it. It may seem strange for us to spend a few minutes on the higher criticism and to spend two or three hours on evolution. But evolution is at the back of the higher criticism, and we'll spend a whole semester, a year from now, on the higher criticism. So there's no need to spend much time on this class, except to show where it came in and what a tremendous force it has been in recent church history. Well, tomorrow we have the test, and then we continue there next week.